Back in 2008, nearly 15 years ago, we hit a really significant milestone in human history. Around the world, more people were living in cities than in rural areas.
Today, about 56% of the world's population is urban. By 2050, it'll be nearly 70%.
Cities have the potential to be really efficient hubs of humanity that can support sustainable living. However, many of them haven't been designed that way, and so urban planners around the world are now trying to create green or smart cities. But just how green or smart are these urban innovations? And do they result in a greener city for everyone, or just a chosen few?
The steady flow of humanity from rural to urban centres has given us the phenomenon of the megacity, a city with a population of 10 million or more. Back in 1950, only New York and Tokyo qualified for the title. By 1980, they were joined by Mexico City, Sao Paulo, and Osaka. In 2010, there were more than 20 megacities dotted across almost every continent. Today, there are around 33 megacities, and by 2030, it's predicted 9% of the global population will live in one of 43 megacities. The magnetic pull of city living is not surprising. Cities are where 80% of the global economy is anchored. They're also where 70 to 75% of energy-related global CO2 emissions stem from. I spoke to three urbanists from Spain, Nigeria, and South Africa to find out why urbanization should be at the heart of any conversation about the planet's future.
So cities are paradoxically both the primary source of some of the environmental challenges we face, especially climate change, but it is also the place where we're going to solve these problems because it aggregates intelligence, people, the economy, value, resources, and so forth.
Cities have opportunities for economic development, and they also have opportunities for people to be able to achieve their aspirations because of the market, because of the scale, because of the diversity. But those types of agglomeration also come with their challenges. For example, the motor cars and the consequences that that might have for stress, for health, and also for the planet with regards to emissions.
Cities are also huge producers of carbon emissions because of the deep extraction of resources and materials from the hinterlands on which cities depend. And then I think one of the last reasons why it's important to include cities is because of the impacts of climate change on urban residents and infrastructure. So many vulnerable groups, including working class residents, informal workers, the elderly, racialized minorities, are facing flooding, heat island effects. Their agglomeration in just a small space really calls for action.
The design of our cities has to factor in not only exponential population growth, but also the precarious state of the climate. One thing urban planners argue strongly against is sprawl, that is, spaced out living. Not only is it impractical when space is at a premium, which so often is in cities, it's also unsustainable because of an inefficient use of resources.
You need to compact the urban form and you need to increase densities. And by the way, density can also be good for cultural diversity, for spatial integration, for social integration. And so the planning language that have emerged to advance this is this idea of what they call transit-oriented development. So you focus on a core public transit system that allows people to cycle more, to walk more, to pedestrianize more road spaces, but also to cluster various kinds of activities in the same building or in the same area.
There are different models that are being advanced here, such as the 15-minute city or the 30-minute city. Others call about bringing streets back to pedestrians and to residents. In Barcelona, for example, 40% of our street space is for cars. And so that amount of carbon emissions and burden on the lives of residents' health is definitely something that cities are now trying to grapple.
The push for decarbonisation and urban greening is growing, and rightly so. It has created a widely shared template of what green cities should look like. Shiny residential towers, waterfront parks, and primarily more wealthy residents. But the parks, cafes, and a riverwalk model of sustainability has been critiqued for providing new green spaces, mainly for the middle classes and upwards, what you could call green gentrification.
These real estate propositions to develop new areas now take on a language of sustainability or climate smart development. What this means is that it's not just that they offer exciting, aesthetically pleasing real estate propositions, but they also say these are low carbon buildings. You can live here with a conscience. And so we've seen the alignment of sustainability imperatives with classic real estate regeneration initiatives to create a new class of gentrification, which is green gentrification.
Green gentrification is a growing process of inequality and displacement and removal in cities that put a lot of emphasis on urban greening. Many cities have an agenda that is linked to greening public spaces, but what's happening along the way is that greening contributes to the construction of new high-end, generally large-scale housing that's becoming more expensive, but also higher property values and property prices. There's higher housing costs for working-class and middle-class residents, and greening can also contribute to segregation in public space. And that's an important aspect that sometimes gets dismissed.
So urban greening can, at times, be less of a climate-centric move and more of a high-end real estate development proposition. It can help attract investment, attention, residents, and rather than incentivize the hard work of decarbonization, it can encourage superficial beautifications that are just a distraction.
Greening can contribute to a form of glitzy urbanism in some cases. So you take Milan and its two vertical skyscrapers called the Bosco Verticale, 17 and 24 floors of luxury housing. Well, the amount of concrete that is required to produce those buildings is not being offset by the 1,500 trees and 15,000 plants that those buildings, you know, beautifully advertise for their apartments. And then what we also see is how urban greening contributes to the marketing of housing for expats, for temporary residents, for tourists. Like in Barcelona, in a neighborhood called Poblenou, we now have a green resilient corridor called Cristóbal de Moura, which is meant to address heat island effects and stormwater management issues. Well, it's great. Finally, Barcelona is turning away from being a city really, really dominated by concrete public spaces to being a city that's integrating nature. However, if you look at the area just around it, you see at least five new luxury hotels. You see a luxury student housing, and you see a type of resident that was long-term traditional resident being displaced by this kind of combination between tourism, real estate, and greening.
Isabel, you've said urban greening gentrifies cities for a sustainability class. What do you mean by this?
We see many spaces that were meant to be public and open that after a while become privatized, or they become occupied by millennials coming there to consume in high-end restaurants that are often adjacent to those luxury buildings. That in that sense, rather than being for the residents for whom they were advertised, those public spaces become segregated. That's what some colleagues of mine call the sustainability class, meaning that you might have supposedly a more local lifestyle because you have everything within walking distance, but many of them use Ubers. You have a very high travel consumption through planes. So I think we have to be very careful here about what greening means.
Greening is much more complex than it seems from a distance. It involves a lot more than just injecting nature into concrete jungles. A holistic approach to developing a sustainable city has to factor in equity, the possibilities of displacement, the dangers of superficial short-term decarbonizing versus long-term structurally significant changes that reduce emissions. Without this kind of multi-layered approach, a campaign to make a city greener could result in what's called green lulus, that is, locally unwanted land uses.
Basically, these are spaces that may seem better from a low-carbon perspective, but are contested by poorer marginalised classes as the area has become greener and more gentrified.
Gentrification, which accompanies the greening of cities, becoming such a pervasive motor of displacement of inequality, because even the middle class itself cannot afford to live in the center of the city and is being displaced 10, 15, 20 miles away. And so when residents talk about green lulus, what they're talking about is not, I don't want greening in my neighborhood. On the contrary, I know what that greening over the midterm is going to produce to me. It's going to accelerate housing costs.
The investment and construction industry have successfully financialized housing so that what is in fact a fundamental human right has been recast as a way to park and grow capital. And now greening is the latest way to continue to sell homes as investment vehicles.
It's a push towards capturing the nouveau riche, emerging middle class, as they say in Africa, who are able to access assets, have spending power, and aspire to global indicators of status. The other thing is that for many of us, particularly in societies where the social safety mechanisms are not so strong, investing in housing is a retirement plan whereby people are able to live beyond their working life based on rents that they may accrue.
And I think when many economists claim that what we need to bring affordable housing back to cities is to build more housing so that demand and offer become a bit more equalized. Actually, the main problem there is that the housing being built, 80% of it is high-end housing. So what you only contribute to is a greater housing price bubble and a greater concentration of housing access for the upper and middle upper class residents.
So how do you build equity in and ensure that greening and environmental cleanup doesn't lead to green gentrification?
On the one hand, you need anti-displacement and anti-gentrification strategies and tools, such as regulations to short-term housing, many more regulations towards hotel constructions, Airbnb. Other cities use taxes on luxury development or have rent control and even rent decrease policies. And on the other hand, you need much more inclusive green development, meaning space for community gardens, for farms, for informal greening, for a form of aesthetical greening that is maybe less glossy, less flashy, but that really responds to the recreational and the health needs of residents.
It's impossible to address this problem without also addressing the underlying rationale of urban development growth models, that private property is sacrosanct. And it is clear that we've got to recognize land as a commons resource and not an individual resource for private accumulation. This, of course, implies a complete paradigm shift in the financial models that underpin how cities are invested in and how cities are reproduced. So that's a big ask. But dealing with these systemic questions, for me, is a precondition for solving the, if you will, the symptomatic problem of displacement.
A lot of attention is given to the housing crises in so-called superstar cities in the global north, London, Frankfurt, New York, Sydney, to name just a few. But as bad as the housing affordability crisis is in these expensive cities, it is even worse in rapidly urbanizing regions of the global south, where rents as share of income average 100%, 150%, 200% or even higher. In these areas, urbanisation has outpaced development, resulting in the creation of teeming but dysfunctional megacities, such as Lagos, Karachi, Kinshasa and Dhaka. Of the 33 megacities on the planet right now, 26 are in the global south. In fact, 90% of future growth is going to be located in Asia and Africa, with Africa set to double its urban population in the next 30 years. If Nigeria's population continues to grow and urbanize at the same rate as now, Lagos could become the world's largest metropolis, home to 85 or 100 million people.
A lot of the conversations around migration, you know, points to migration of Africans to the global north, whereas a lot of the migration that is happening within the continent, across countries, but primarily directed at cities. So you have young people from Nigerian cities trying to move to Accra because of the opportunities in the tech. For those who are not so fortunate to have, you know, basic education, they are also moving. But this time around, they are getting jobs in the informal economy, which can be precarious.
Up to 80% of people in the labor force in African cities are engaged with informal economic activity. In other words, they don't have a permanent industrial job. They don't have regular, steady wages. They've got to hustle all the time. Now, if your income is variable and precarious and low, then it also means that you can't live formally. You end up living in a slum. So this is really the distinctive fact of African urbanization.
As our cities continue to grow and their carbon emissions balloon, there's often a misplaced focus on population growth as the key driver of increased pollution. It's a simplistic reading that mistakes correlation for the cause, because what's really at the root of rising emissions in our growing cities is often carbon-intensive urban design and city living, especially in the global north.
There is a deep injustice, which is that residents of the global south, and especially lower income residents, are those who have produced the least carbon emissions, are most exposed to the impacts of climate change, have the fewest resources to cope. And on top of that, I would say are those who benefit the least from climate resilient infrastructure and might even be displaced by it.
Over the past decade, multiple African countries have tried to untangle some of the knots in how their big cities have developed by proposing urban utopias. Often called smart cities or tech cities, they promise to solve the problems of poverty and economic stagnation through tech-enabled, citizen-responsive and carbon-neutral urban planning.
Tartu City represents a new way of living for all Kenyans, creating a unique live, work and play environment.
So far, so good. However, when you probe beyond the big promises and the snappily written marketing spiel, there is often a gap between ambitions for eco-friendly cities and the complications of building ideal urban spaces amidst existing structures and systems.
Because a lot of the cities, especially in the global south, are really complicated, messy places, messy as in they've got multiple systems of organization, formal and informal, multiple forms of governance that, again, formal and informal. They feel it is almost impossible to intervene into those contexts and to create an environment within which you can test these new cutting edge smart city technologies. So they are then persuaded to say, why don't you go to a site and you can really create the ideal imagined city of the future that is free of all of those complications.
Nigeria's aspirations to develop an African model megacity has produced Echo Atlantic, a brand new coastal city that has been in development since 2009 in Lagos State. The plans include everything from skyscrapers to luxury apartments, a new financial district, a private power grid, and a shopping boulevard in the image of New York's Fifth Avenue. All of this high-end urbanization sits on land reclaimed from the Atlantic Ocean. The developers said that the creation of this city, rather than causing any environmental complications, would in fact help tackle long-running issues of erosion along Nigeria's southwestern coast. Furthermore, the documentation for Eco Atlantic says the reclamation and associated activities may cause disturbance to the local water quality. However, with the implementation of best practice measures on site, effects would be only of a minor nature.
Many of the grand designs that were meant to accompany Echo Atlantic has just not come to pass. But more importantly, ironically, this development has actually exacerbated certain climate change impacts in the city of Lagos. And so what these new towns do is they suck in all of the available public resources for infrastructure and innovation into these sites. And it means that nothing is being attended to in terms of the real cities that already exist where the majority of people live. So it is not just that they are often inappropriate for context, but also they have a distraction effect.
The other thing is that where Eco Atlantic stands today used to be the Lagos Bar Beach. Unfortunately, creation of that exclusive island is a major manifestation of gentrification, whereby a green solution has come and has effectively removed access for the entire city for the benefit of the 300 or so thousand people who will eventually inhabit Eco Atlantic City. It's a very good engineering idea and all of that. But the average Lagosian just doesn't resonate.
If you're new to the urban renewal scene, you're probably wondering why and how smart city projects have become so ubiquitous. Well, a big part of the answer lies in global management consultancies that are doing roaring business in urban planning. Companies like Boston Consulting Group, Accenture, and McKinsey.
Why is climate adaptation so important for Africa and African cities?
The consulting firms talk a good talk about how to develop cities.
In addition to building resilient infrastructure, we need to build resilient communities.
Inclusion, sustainability, equitability. All of these are reliably included in plans for privately funded, so-called cities of the future. However, these shiny visions often don't marry up with principles of social or climate justice. It's not surprising there's something called the Global City Livability Rankings, and all cities jostle to get onto those listings. They put cities into a pecking order. A couple of the criteria can be outlandish.
You see some of them having ridiculous indicators like the number of African stores. And for a city like Lagos, where many people are living below the poverty level, then that is a redundant, ridiculous indicator of how smart that city is, because people are able to get online or have access to the internet from devices other than those produced by Apple.
I can see why they are pursued and why they make sense to certain policy leaders and so on. But of course, you know, they only measure certain things, and so they never give you a holistic picture of what is actually going on in a particular city.
Oftentimes, being on these livability or sustainability index pre-qualifies certain cities to attract foreign investment. I think that's why many of the African cities push to be listed on them. I remember a few years ago, some Lagos State government officials said, even though we're doing so poorly, at least we're on the index.
With more than 50% of humanity living in urban settings, cities are right on the front lines of the climate crisis. How they develop, function and evolve all have an impact. The buzz around cities and their efforts to develop sustainably all sounds very promising. In October 2022, the C40 Summit, a gathering of mayors from cities across the world, took place in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
C40 mayors are united in action to lead the transition away from pollution-based economies to a people-centered future by creating cleaner, greener, and fairer cities.
It's a big ask. Cities have complex networks of power and money, and navigating those overlapping and often competing interests is a huge challenge, especially when the effort is to transition to an urban system geared not just towards climate justice, but social justice as well.
What becomes difficult is to actually control developers and make developers abide by certain regulations because you're afraid of pushing developers away. So you really deep dependence at the local level on real estate development for financing schools, for financing public hospitals, for financing firefighters. It makes you really be quite trapped if you don't have deeper support at the state and federal level.
It is really, really important that cities have more space and scope to do the radical things and to become the exemplars of the kind of political transformation we need. The challenge with all of this is that there is certainly a lot of scope for greenwashing. So what we've seen with a lot of the global networks and the declarations and so forth is that a lot of effort is expended to present a picture and to present a story that a certain city is in fact sustainable or is green.
We have shown that you can be a sustainable city while maintaining a thriving economy.
But actually, less than 5% of day-to-day operations of the functioning of that municipality or city government has actually changed. It is pretty much business as usual, but they invest a significant amount in communications and marketing to tell a different story.
It isn't enough for our green cities to simply be low carbon or sustainable. Climate justice that makes equity and fairness equally as important as low emissions and low waste needs to be central to modern urban planning. After all, climate change is causing problems for everyone. It only makes sense that the solutions we build are for everyone too.
Cities should be for people, not for profit. And if cities are for people, profit will invariably, you know, accompany that enterprise. Because cities have huge populations and a ready market, ensuring that social and environmental considerations are prioritized in economic decision making, you know, it's a win-win all round.
There is no blueprint. We have to take each city in its own historical cultural setting and understand what is needed there. And those priorities has to be set by the citizens themselves. And then see how do we transition it onto a more inclusive and sustainable pathway.
Thanks so much for watching episode 5 of All Hail the Planet, a series looking at the forces undermining meaningful action on climate change. If you'd like to check out the other episodes, we have one on carbon offsetting, technological optimism, consumerism, plastic waste. You can easily use the hashtag All Hail the Planet on social media. Otherwise, search for All Hail on aljazeera.com.